I heard two completely programmatically unrelated broadcasts in the last couple of days that felt in my imagination like they had something to do with one another. One was, I don't know what the show was because it was I was driving and I sort of just dropped in the middle of it and then, you know, dropped back out. But one of them was about, was it one of those podcast review shows? It wasn't podcast playlist, but something similar to that, where the hosts were basically talking to people about the podcasts that they do in this particular case. And one of the conversations was with some folks who were doing a podcast on friendship. And they interviewed a bunch of people about their experiences around making friends and how the skill set that we seem to have till we're like four, we lose somewhere after that. This just walk up to someone and say, will you be my friend? That part just goes away, gets buried in all kinds of layers of other things. So that was one of them. And one of the hosts of that podcast, which deals with friendship all the time, was talking about something we've talked about and referenced here many times, about the epidemic of loneliness, about how, although it's never been easier for us to communicate with one another, we have more and more people who are just the person you described, Sarah, who are just dying for a hug, like literally in many cases dying for a hug. And how do we relearn, how do we recover this, will you be my friendness? You know, the audacity to expect, the personal confidence to expect, the hope to expect, whatever, to the courage, wherever the courage comes from, to just go up to someone socially in whatever way we do that, and approach them with the hope that we may, in this person, discover a new friend and that we may, in fact, be able to be to them a new friend. So there was that one. And then this morning on the drive in, the drive show host on CBC One was interviewing a couple of folks who, one of whom works for, is the compost director for some kind of recycling initiative, and another one directs part of it works for the Buy Nothing organization and directs a series of Facebook groups that are about connecting people with their immediate neighbors so they can exchange things. And they were using the language of gift, but they were and they were talking about such ordinary things, a cup of sugar, or you could also ask for gifts. You could also say, I could really use thing X, does anybody want to gift that to me? But it was all about the few blocks right around you. So it was hyper-local was the term that this person used. So on the one hand, sort of these people who are going, we see the epidemic of loneliness, and we want to do something about it because we believe that we can be a gift to one another. And on the other hand, somebody kind of observing the wider systemic dilemma of, seem to be an awful lot of us that aren't either being a gift to one another or aren't able or don't have occasion or however it happens, we're not receiving that gift of someone else being in our life as a friend. The importance of people that come into our lives in different ways and impact us sort of felt like it connected for me to something that I want to at least begin this morning. We'll see how it goes. We might end up spilling over into next week with this, but we're going to get started on it this morning for sure. A friend of mine, singer-songwriter named Alana Lewandowski, Alana's doing this thing right now to people that are kind of on her mailing list, where she's sending out what she calls a Sunday song and rumination. And this woman's a deep thinker and a big reader, and she's covered lots of ground in her own journey. Really fascinating person to me. And this morning's rumination was partly about, she titled it Bob Marley, Johnny Cash, Story and Non-Duality. I'm not going to unpack all of that, but just this one little segment, she was talking about her own journey and the things that impacted her. And I want to read you just a little bit of what she wrote. She's talking about letting go of old stories in this particular part of what she wrote. Letting go of the old story, her personal old stories, what she's talking about there, initially proved to be very hard for me to do for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, with my dualistic lens, was because it was difficult for me to work out how I could let go of the attachment I had to my story without it ruining story as an art form. So when our own story feels like it's just not working, how do you process that and how do you let go of that old story without letting go of the value that's carried by the thing that we would use a proper noun like story for the name of a thing. She describes herself this way. She says, I was the kid with flashlight under quilt, jousting my way across the deck, trusty cutlass raised, joining in the mutiny for justice and change, identifying with each orphan in every classic as though it were me in their place, overcoming great odds. On one page, I could be Eowyn riding her way into battle with wee Mary riding in front. On another, I looked out from the eyes of Smeagol in his dark cave of despair. Story taught me how to see through the eyes of others, and it taught me about my own interiority, not a word we might use in conversation every day. It taught me about my own interiority as someone who could feel the darkness and the light. I took story out of my wild environment along the national park where I grew up, and much of what might have just been a tree or a pond or a wood took shape in ways that opened up much deeper dimensions of thisness, so the particularity of place. When I first encountered the Christian mystics and deep dove into the wisdom teachings, the practices, and the revelations about duality, I began to see very, very clearly how attachment to my story was causing quite a lot of damage. The way in which I identified with it wasn't moving my own story forward for growth and renewal, but was really more about repeating history in such a way that I was held captive. So the irony was that the more I identified with it, the less available I was to the new chapters of it. The more I identified with it, the less available I was to new chapters of it. So rather than leaving the story, how do we stay in story, even when our own story perhaps is difficult or feels like it's not moving us forward? How can we still stay attached to the power of story, including our own, but to new chapters of it? And what the point Alana's making is that seeing our story as an either-or thing, so that's the dualism she's talking about, that's where we get stuck. Because then we're like, oh, if that story wasn't working, I have to leave that whole story, if we're thinking dualistically, either-or. I got to just leave the whole thing. It's all or nothing. As a person who self-identifies as a Christian, but who's not a big fan of dualism, I feel like I run into this all the time. I'm constantly talking to people who are like, yeah, well, I grew up with this tradition and this set of beliefs, and from where I sit right now, a lot of that's not believable, which means none of it's believable. That's what Alana's talking about, right? Got to leave the whole story because I can't unfold it into a new chapter. No, no, no. There's actually a way to see both the story of where we come from and to own that and to treat it in a way that opens into a next or a more or a further into the next chapter. Part of the problem is that lots of us have been trained to think about stories as either ors, including our spiritual stories. And if we grew up with a hegemonic spirituality, with a spirituality that says everything true is inside of the boundaries of this code of beliefs, and everything outside of it is not true or dangerous or destructive, that's a very natural way to feel if something inside of the circle stops working. But things inside of a circle of belief, inside of a system of belief, stop working for us all the time. We have this experience like every week, like honestly, at the rate of change that we're living with in our culture, where something's like, oh, well, I thought that's how that worked. That's not how that works anymore. So we get a phrase like, is that still a thing? Okay, right? This is the vernacular for that experience. Is that still a thing? Does it still work that way? No, it doesn't still work that way. Well, what was that thing sat in? What was the system it sat in? Do we have to throw out the whole system? Oh, that's not the way you communicate to your friend anymore? Does that mean we don't have friendship anymore? Right? This is the absurdity, as somebody pointed out this last week, of the, you know, our powerful leader to the south saying, hey, what's this thing with climate change? They just had a cold snap somewhere. Like, I heard somebody describe that statement as being like saying, being on the deck of the Titanic and saying, I don't think it's going down. The end that I'm standing on just went up 200 feet. Like, isn't that great? It's a kind of conflation that we're familiar with. We do this with beliefs all the time. That can't be true because the experience I'm having over here is whoop, right? And so, anyway, that's how dualism behaves. All that to say this. What I want to do for this morning and then going forward a little bit is I want us to have a look at an old idea in contemporary terms. Old, this is from the late 1940s is where this kind of really got some traction. It has remained a powerful idea framework for stories and how they change us. It's also come under lots of criticism, of course, like any idea. We'll talk about where some of that criticism comes from, not by way of defending the idea, but by helping us understand it a little more. This is not going to be an academic treatise on the idea because, first of all, I don't think that's that interesting, and second of all, I'm not qualified to give one. So rather, it's going to be an approach to a system of thinking about stories that I hope will help us open up our stories with one another. All right, so that's what I'm hoping for. So enough ambiguity about the system. This is from Joseph Campbell's work. For those of you that might have encountered this in some literary theory class somewhere along the course of your education, Campbell wrote about what he called the hero's journey. The book was Hero with a Thousand Faces, I think, was sort of the popular title that got some traction. An incredibly dense, hard-to-read book, so don't. I would say, unless you just have nothing but time, I wouldn't wade into that particular book. But out of Campbell's work came this theory about the journeys that we go on and how they transform us. And one of the reasons that Campbell's work has come under fire in the academy is because he took that theory and he moved it into a realm that he called monomyth. Basically, the idea was that we can take all the mythologies that we encounter and they actually all have this one shape. This one basic shape. And the logical protest was, that's not particular enough. That's not contextual enough. So Joseph Campbell was writing before, if any of you studied any theory of almost any structural kind in university, you ran across intersectionality or related set of ideas, this idea that everything we experience happens at the interstices of a whole bunch of other things. It has a particular context, and that deeply informs the shape of the idea. The protest about Campbell's work is about the monomyth, one story that gathers them all, and I think one critic called it a soup of myths. So it was so not particular as to be of no use. So that's the critique. Whatever. I'm not saying that that's a legitimate realm. Have at it. I don't care at this particular intersection very much about that. I want you to know I'm aware of it so that you don't think that this is some new dualism. This is far more complex and nuanced than that. But I do want to unpack the theory just a little bit so we can work with it at this intersection together, so we can do something with it ourselves, all right? So Campbell breaks this thing down into like 17 pieces, and my goodness, I'm still not gonna unpack all of those, but I'm gonna unpack some of the big bits, all right? So Judy, if you'd get this is very teachery, we're gonna actually have this on the board, on the screen, and kind of go through this diagram. How do you like it so far? Oh, there we go, okay. Huh? Hey?
Did you make that?
Oh no. I stole that. I would be impressed with me if I made that, Jane. And you would be too, wouldn't you? Because that's a nice diagram. Okay. All right. So I called it the transformative journey instead of the hero's journey. So that's my little tweak right away because, frankly, one of the things I don't like about the idea of a hero's journey is that we immediately have to translate it into a world where gender is not only not male, but it's not even binary. And so I'm interested in the transformative part of this, not the male dominance of it. But the male dominance of that zenith of patriarchy in the Western world of the late 1940s, early 1950s, shows up in the theory all over the place. So just to kind of be aware of that, not least of all when we hit the bottom, where Campbell made a great deal out of the father figure. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. We'll get there. So just a couple things about these bits, because I want us to think about our own stories and lay them over this, and then talk about them together, okay? So important kind of to see this. Jane, can you see past me? Okay. So important to kind of understand that this is in two chunks, known and unknown. There's an experience that we can probably relate to, right? This sense of moving from something that we thought we knew to something that we're pretty sure we don't, from the known to the unknown. Hugely important part of being transformed or having new chapters open in our lives. So at the beginning of this model, Campbell offers something that he often referred to as departure or the call to adventure is how it shows up there. And this is when we kind of think we know how things are going along, and then something happens that says to us, it's time to move, it's time to change, it's time to grow, something needs to shift here. And that's not always got that kind of clarity to it, right? It's not so singular, but that's what it gathers together under, is this sense of time for something to shift in my life. And in that is almost always, and this is the bit that we'll come back to in our conversation, is almost always an experience of feeling like we're leaving home in some way, or leaving something that feels like home to us. So that departure, that call to adventure, almost always has something about it that feels like it's leaving home. And it often also includes, this isn't on the diagram, many of these things will sort of flesh that out, it often also includes an experience of refusal of the call, of saying, I don't think so. And we can say, I don't think so for a long time about a call to change in our lives, right? If you want this, and one of the reasons, when this stuff first started to gain serious traction in the Christian Academy, so of course that was decades later than it gained traction in the non-Christian Academy, so I'm in my college education when this stuff is starting to show up in Christian education, people lost their minds about it, where I was, because they were like, ah, you're trying to tell me that all these stories that are so formative for me, they're all myths, they all get bundled under this monomyth thing, my God, that's, I mean, they wouldn't say my God, of course, because that's, but that's terrible, you can't do that, you can't tell me that, you know, anyway, just start laying this model over some of the great biblical stories, and you'll see that Campbell's on about something. So, for instance, this refusal of call, as soon as I was starting reading through this stuff, I'm like, I'm thinking about the Moses story, right, which has, like, these epic refusals of call in it. There's a cycle of refusals of call in that story. I don't think so. I'm not the guy. I can't talk that great. I can't, like, there's this whole series of not me, not me, not me. And that's sort of this process. The sense of this bush says something to this guy, and he's like, I better pay attention. That sounds like a call to change. And then as the details start to unfold, at least in their imagination, they're like, no, I think I was wrong about that. I don't really think it's time to change. So that's often part of the process, right? Is we just feel like, I don't know, that's an interesting idea, but that's not for me, for whatever reason. And then, still in the realm of the known, the person who's called to be changed meets what Campbell calls a threshold guardian, somebody who sort of stands on this line between the known and the unknown and says to the adventurer or the one being called to transformation, I can help you with this threshold. I can help you with this initial movement from what you think you know to what you feel confident or certain that you don't know. I can help you move from the realm of the known into the realm of the unknown. We might call a person like that a mentor. Basically, that's a person that we meet that can help us in our journey. And we might not realize that we've met that person at the time, but when we look back on our story, we're like, oh yeah, that person was really helpful in that process. So that's what we're talking about. Often, we experience a person like this as somebody that might give us some reassurance about what we're musing about or wrestling with in terms of refusal to go on this adventure. They might give us some tools that help us along the way. When I think about these people in my life, I often think about authors. This is often, for me, those people have often been people who've written down their own journey in some way, and I've got a chance to read it and gone, there we go, I can take another step with that. And often when we act on the sorts of things that these people have given us in our lives, the experience we have is of congruence. They give us something, we act on it, and all of a sudden it feels like something in our life goes ka-chunk. That experience, right? That's what they're, So lots of times we'll experience that, and depending on how you view spirituality in the world, we might feel like something in the universe kind of lined up in a way that before was just like just all over, and it was incongruent and scattered. So those people are really important, those mentors, those people who help us cross the threshold. And then, because we cross the threshold twice in this journey, there's this first crossing of the threshold, and that's where we actually move into what Campbell calls the field of adventure. We leave the known limits of the world we know, and we venture into the unknown and the dangerous realm where rules and limits are unknown, into something that's truly new. If you watch the Lord of the Rings films or you read the books, you could imagine this is that moment where Sam and Frodo are leaving the Shire and they're walking through the field in the film and they come to this boundary in the film and Sam in the field and Sam says, if I take one more step, I'm going to be further from home than I've ever been in my life. That's this moment in this model, all right? So this point where we're like, okay, I am leaving behind the sphere that I feel like I understand. I'm venturing into the unknown. We might have a sensation there of feeling like leaving home as a child felt, or as a young adult, however that process went for us, or we might have the sensation of leaving a tribe, leaving the security of some place or some group or some community where we know the rules and we know how it works, and now we're going into a realm where we don't know that. So that version of tribalism. And then we enter this challenges and temptations stage, and again, there's mentors, there's helpers, there's people who come into our journey at these critical points, and I'm going to invite us to reflect on who some of those people might be for us as individuals. But there's a chunk of this journey that Campbell often talked about as the belly of the whale. which, of course, for most of us, in terms of the traditions we've grown up around, we kind of know that story, right? This is Jonah, and Jonah's got this call, right? Then the refusal of call, big time refusal of call, get in a boat, go the other direction, like screw this call. I am so not going down that path. And then the storm, so this trial, and then getting pitched overboard, even a bigger trial, and getting swallowed by this fish and spending these days in the belly of the whale, reconsidering the call, and then getting barfed up on the beach and going, all right, I'm in, right? So the belly of the whale is sort of this metaphor for what it means to metamorphosize, to change. And when in Campbell's model, when the hero or adventurer is entering this stage, they often encounter additional setbacks, additional things that make it feel like, I don't think saying yes to this adventure is a good idea. I mean, getting caught in a shipwrecker of a storm where you get picked out as the problem and tossed overboard is enough to make anyone wonder, you know, how this is going to go in terms of that story. So that's kind of the belly of the whale part. And then there's what Campbell calls initiation. On the diagram, it's called challenges and temptations, which is interesting language. And all of that bundled together leads to this point at the bottom of the curve, and lots of these kind of models have a bottom to the curve, and it's important that we kind of bottom out in lots of models of recovery or change or transition, right? So at the bottom of this curve is something called revelation or the abyss, death and rebirth. Something has to be let go of in order for us to move to the next chapter in our story. Something has to die for something else to be born. Not an unusual experience in terms of transformation. And this is a place where Campbell gets kind of stuck, I think, in terms of psychological models. And, of course, a great deal has been made of this by all kinds of psychologists as well. There's a whole school of psychology that came out of this hero's journey stuff, especially in the men's movement. Anyway, what this is an encounter in the model, an encounter with something powerful that has to be moved beyond. And in Campbell's model, that's often a negative father figure, which is kind of interesting in the history of Christian religion and conceptions of God the Father that aren't that positive. Anyway, I'm not going to talk a lot about atonement, although Campbell makes a great deal of it, because I find that's going to kind of confuse, I think, what we're doing here this morning. But I want to read you a little bit of this. So this is Campbell writing about what they call atonement, and they're going to use psychological language for some of this stuff. So just stay with me and use your imagination about your own experience of your conceptions of God. Atonement consists in no more than the abandonment of that self-generated double monster, the dragon thought to be God, brackets superego, and the dragon thought to be sin, repressed id. So there's that particular other model showing up. But this requires an abandonment of the attachment to ego itself, and that is what is difficult. One must have a faith that the Father is merciful and then a reliance on that mercy. Therewith, the center of belief is transferred outside of the bedeviling God's tight, scaly ring, and the dreadful ogres dissolve. Easier when you're looking at it than when you're listening to it. I'll read just a little bit more and then we'll go on. It is in this ordeal that the hero may derive hope and assurance from the helpful female figure by whose magic they are protected through all the frightening experience of the Father's ego-shattering initiation. For it is impossible to trust the terrifying father face when one's faith must be centered elsewhere, and with that reliance for support, one endures the crisis, only to find, in the end, that the father and the mother figures reflect each other and are, in essence, the same. The problem of the hero going to meet the father is to open their soul beyond terror to such a degree that they will be ripe to understand how the sickening and insane tragedies of this vast and ruthless cosmos are completely validated in the majesty of being. The hero transcends life with its peculiar blind spot and for a moment rises to a glimpse of the source. He beholds the face of the Father, understands, and the two are atoned. So that's what Campbell would write about that stuff. It's like a full immersion experience in a completely different language. So this is what it feels like, right? The point being that at the bottom of this curve of the experience of being transformed as people, we encounter something powerful. For Campbell, that's a male entity, but that doesn't kind of matter. And laying this onto our stories, we encounter something that has to die in order for something new to be born. It's the seed that goes into the ground to germinate. It's the belief that we recognize that doesn't just not work anymore. I don't think that's true anymore. I have to let go of that to be open to what's true beyond it, what it points to. And that leads into transformation. And that leads into this journey of receiving something. Campbell calls it the ultimate boon, which kind of makes sense in terms of the mythic language, right? In the story, the hero or heroine receives something that is magical, something that is powerful to do something good with. Would be another way to talk about it. If you read Malcolm Gladwell at all, Gladwell will talk about in contemporary terms about what's your superpower. That's the same idea, basically. What do you have uniquely that's uniquely yours out of the transforming journey that you've been on that is something that you can give to others? Okay, so that's kind of the core of that idea. This is where we consider what we might have learned or gained that can be shared with others for good. And then there's the part where the person being transformed on this journey returns to the realm that they know with that good thing or those good things. And there's also a refusal of return, because that's part of this journey often, where we're kind of like, yeah, I've got this thing that feels like it's good in my life, but I don't think it's going to work in the world I came from. I just don't see how that could be. So we have to work through that, right? Can I actually carry this back? I have this conversation with people about their spirituality all of the time, right? They've left something because they needed to leave. They were stuck in a negative repetition of their story, and they leave it because they know they have to or they're going to blow up. And they move into something new, they learn new things, they feel like it's transformative, they love it, there's something new growing in their lives that's blossoming, that feels good and beautiful, and then they think, yeah, but you know, my family of origin, they haven't been on this journey. If I take this thing that feels lovely to me back there, it's going to get stepped on. It's not going to do something good. It's just going to be a cat fight at Christmas, whatever, right? Like, there's no room for this gift there. That's the refusal of call to that other threshold. And we have to work through that, right? We have to decide, is this a good gift there? How could this be a good gift there? How do I carry this transformed me and the gifts that I carry with that back into the realm of what I knew when I left on this adventure? It's an interesting model. And then out of that kind of saying yes and crossing the return threshold comes a freedom to live with an expanded sense, and Campbell uses the word mastery, which is a word that I find both interesting and problematic, with a sense of being able to master life in two worlds, being able to live in two worlds at the same time. Both a world of sort of that chaos and challenge that Campbell talks about, but also a world in which, how does he say it? I kind of like this sentence. The easy thing is to commit the whole community that you've come from to the devil and retire again into the heavenly rock dwelling and close the door and make it fast. So just basically go back to the place where you were transformed and where you encountered the thing that felt good and lovely and just stay there. And don't come back to where you came from. But if some spiritual obstetrician has closed off the possibility of retreat, then the work of representing eternity in time, of perceiving in time eternity, cannot be avoided. And so the hero returns to the world of common day and must accept that world also as real. Interesting, hey? I find it interesting. The idea of freedom to live in that tension and not be locked up by it in our own journey is a very, very important idea if we actually believe that spirituality should be transformative. And lots of us maybe don't believe that, or we haven't had that experience. That's not how we've experienced spirituality. Maybe we haven't experienced something we would use a word like spirituality for. We've experienced religion, but not spirituality. And it hasn't been transformative. It's been about learning a code and keeping a code instead of about being transformed as people. But I think as people who, by and large, in this room stand in the tradition of Christian spirituality, I don't see how you can come at the person and work and teachings of Jesus and not see the goal of that as transformation. Like, that whole story just sort of falls apart for me unless we believe that it's actually meant to be transformative, to actually change us as people. Not just someday somewhere else, but here and now. So I think that's partly why this set of ideas was so resonant for me. So we're going to start into the questions that come out of this. I'm going to have to recap it way more briefly next week, but I want more time for us to talk about this and out of a series of questions that come out of this. But we'll just start at the beginning of the journey, and what I want us to do is take the opportunity to reflect on our own stories and journeys and to actually talk together about those. So maybe you've never had a sense of a transformative spiritual experience. You don't have to like put up your hand and say, I'm sorry, I don't get any of this because that's all foreign. But just think about experiences that you've had in your life where you feel like something important had to change. All right? And think about that in terms of the language that we're using here, a call to adventure. And this is for the podcast people. If you're listening to this on a podcast, send me an email and I'll send you all the questions, but we're not going to record this part, obviously, because people are going to talk about their own stories and that doesn't go to the interweb.